I apologize for the delays. We've been talking about the avos and what each of the avos, according to our very limited understanding, what each of them added to the big picture of our Yiddishkeit. So we move on to talk about Yaakov Avinu this week. Yaakov Avinu and his family. Yaakov Avinu, in a number of places, is referred to as Bechir HaAvos, the choicest of the Avos. But the truth is, it's really very hard to try to identify. Certainly not based on anything we know, because everything we know is a tiny part of who these immense people were. But also more than that, in terms of trying to look at the Makairis, you will find good substantiation naming each of the three Avos as the choicest of the Avos in different ways. And obviously, that means that there were various angles and various elements. So we're not going to get into that, certainly not. But we will just note that obviously there is an element about Yaakov Avinu which we should be studying well. I'm sorry? Who? How did they know? They were operating with a level of Ruach HaKodesh, but let's see, maybe we'll touch on that. Maybe we'll touch on that. How did they know how to give the names that they give? Let's see, maybe we'll come back to that at the end. Perhaps we'll come back to that at the end. Perhaps we'll come back to that at the end. Bli nether. Okay. Yaakov Avinu. So we discussed last week how Avram and Yitzchak each laid down some of the very fundamental building blocks of Yiddishkeit, if we'll just use that broad term. Avram Avinu, the Chesed, Ahava, really laid down the broad strokes for what primarily characterizes our relationship with Hashem. We had Yitzchak who came and fine-tuned it by adding the Yiro, the Gvura element. And now we move on to Yaakov Avinu. So Yaakov Avinu, I want to start by with the following point. It is a little bit more textual, and then we'll see how it really relates to us l'maaseh. Yaakov Avinu, we know what his journey was. After he left his parents' home, Chazal tell us, even though if you look at the Psukim, he went straight from his parents' home to Haran, well, we know that there was actually a significant interval. He was in Yeshivas Shem Ve'Eiver for 14 years, taking in, soaking up everything they had to offer until he finally moved on to the house of Lavan. Now, here's something interesting. Rabbi Avigdor Miller points out when he leaves the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Eiver, where he had been totally immersed in Torah learning, I don't know how to compare that to the years when he was at his home, because when he was in his parents' home, he was also totally immersed in Torah learning. I'll just say in parentheses, what exactly does Torah learning mean in those times? There's a combination of elements. If we'll just talk what we'll call pshat, it's what Rabbi Avigdor Miller called teras haseichem. Or, where Reb Chaim Kanievsky put it, he was studying Yiras Shamayim, which are really the same point. In other words, they were studying what we might call the process of the Chovos HaLevavos, if we're talking on Derech HaPshat. Studying Hashem deeper and deeper and deeper. And as we have discussed, learning up the implications of Hashem's existence in the process Mamash that the Chovos HaLevavos goes through substantiating Hashem, to making to internalizing Hashem and making it into a sensory awareness, going from there to a sense of indebtedness, to a sense of submission, and going through, basically, if you follow the stages of the Chovos HaLevavos, it's really a process of contemplation and study. I'm using the Chovos HaLevavos just as an easy reference, but that's the idea. And they were constantly refining their sensitivities, understanding more about their obligations toward Hashem. And through this process, they really reached very, very much of the Torah that we actually have today. Many of the mitzvahs that we have today, they conceived through their own long thought processes. And then there was an awful lot of contemplation and study involved, and Ruach HaKodesh kicked in also. And they were actually studying a lot of our Torah. But
I just read the Parsha, and there's all this deception going on. I mean, if he was so straight with Hashem, wouldn't he trust that if the bracha was meant to come to him, it would, and he wouldn't have to go get all dressed up with somebody else and pretend to be somebody else? I mean, if you read it straight, it didn't seem very innocent to me.
oh, okay, here we have another question on the particulars of Yaakov Avinu's life. What was with the whole story of the deception in order to get the brachas? So let's leave this also, see if we can come back to this at the end. I still want to talk about the broader strokes.
They knew everything, but it's not to do about that. But so she knew, they knew already that who Esav was. So what's the
She knew,
whole?
Yitzchak did it. She knew, she
She
knew.
knew that. Why not? She knew.
She knew. Rivka knew. But Yitzchak hadn't gotten that nevuah. She got the nevuah.
Well, they gave him the name Esav, so they knew already that he was fully named what he was.
Okay, but let's see if we can come back to that.
He liked Esav because of the food.
Okay, there's many, many, many different pieces here
So,
that have to be put together. Let's see. I'm going to try to keep track of these questions and see if we can come back and touch on them at the end. But right now, I still want to proceed with the broader picture. The broader picture. Blineta, I'm going to try to come back to these questions at the end. So, Yaakov Avinu goes for his 14 years in Shein Va'eilim. He then moves on to his 20 years in the house of Lavan. It's a very different experience. And one was mamish sitting in a pure environment and just having the leisure to be spending your entire life in. And he took good advantage of his time, as we're told. He never actually lied down throughout those 14 years. Any sleeping he did, in his position sitting up. And this went on. It was a utopian 14 years in spiritual terms. And then he went on to mamish in the mud, right? Busy dealing with Lavan the whole time, while at the same time raising a large family and at the same time involved with the shepherding, which, as we see from Yaakov's description at the end of the parsha, was not just a leisurely profession, but was a very intense, rigorous, and torturous one. And he's trying to do all this together. So now let's note something. He finishes his 14 years of Shein Va'eiver and he has a vision, right? This is beginning of Parshas Vayishlach. Sorry, beginning of Parshas Vayetze, this week's Parsha. And this makes sense. Yaakov gets a nevuah after 14 years of concentrated, pure spiritual growth. It culminates in a nevuah. That makes sense. Makes sense. Works with everything we already know. But what's interesting is that at the end of the parsha, also, when he's leaving the house of Lavan, he also gets a nevuah. The parsha begins and ends with a nevuah. But the difference is that the nevuah that he gets when he leaves the house of Lavan is a higher level nevuah. In what way? The nevuah that he had at the beginning of the parsha was a nevuah that he had in a dream. The nevuah that he had at the end of the parsha was a nevuah that he had while he was up. It was a vision that he had, which is a higher level of a nevuah. And this actually seems counterintuitive because in the beginning of the parsha, he was coming out of an immersion in the yeshiva of Shein Va'eiver. At the end of the parsha, he's coming up to 20 years, he's coming out of the mud. So the truth is that this already gives us an idea of what it is that Yaakov Avinu really introduced. It's called Yaakov Avinu is identified with the Midah of Tiferes, which gave a very, very broad and faint idea of what exactly the significance of it is. But the idea of Tiferes is that it brings together. We saw Avram with the Midah of Chesed and Ahava, and Yitzchak with the Gvura and the Yira, and Tiferes brings the blend together. But now, but let's take that a step further. Avram Avinu blazed the trail in Avodas Hashem. Yaakov didn't have the luxury to blaze trails. Yaakov pretty much, well, at least after his period in the Yeshiva of Shein Va'eiver, life was dictating to him. He wasn't dictating his life. He was being blown around by all kinds of different events, a very, very intense and rigorous life. He describes it later. It was a tough life. But this is exactly what he brought into the mix, if we'll put it that way. The understanding that we now have to find the kedusha and the avodas Hashem in the rigors of whatever our life circumstances are. Meaning, you look at Avraham Avinu's life, and you say, okay, a life of avodas Hashem looks like, has the look of a chesed enterprise, a person who is out there gathering the masses and teaching about Hashem and drawing people together and being mekarev. Yaakov Avinu didn't have the luxury to do that. Yaakov Avinu is busy contending with the rigors of life in a very, very intense way. But this is where Yaakov Avinu introduced a whole new dimension of greatness. Dimension of greatness as in taking the rigors of what we would call everyday life, we would even say the challenges, even use the word the drudgery, right, of everyday life, and bringing out the brilliance, the magnificence of Avodas Hashem there. And this is what we want to take home from our, like I said, our broad study of the life of Yaakov Avinu here. But Victor Miller pointed out, he said that this is the pshat. Yaakov Avinu was certainly in a great growth process when he came out of the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Evan. But it was 20 years later, during which he presumably didn't have, well, he had a chalom at some point, but in general, he wasn't getting nevuos then for two reasons. He was in Chutz La'aretz. And number two, to get nevuos, you have to be in a certain state of serenity, a certain state of meditation, etc., which it seems that in a general way, Yaakov Avinu didn't really have the luxury to do. And yet, what did he do? He went through all those rigors and applied himself to them with the principles that he had gotten from Avraham and Yitzchak, the principles of his great forefathers. And when he came out of there, even though you might have thought, okay, he's just a worn down, he wasn't busy innovating spiritual paths here. He was just worn down from 20 years of hard labor and challenges. And yet, Lemaisa, he comes to a much greater place of Nevuah, which means that it's true. Throughout the period, he couldn't get Nevuah. He was actually bringing himself to much, much, much higher levels by dealing with those, by turning all those challenges, integrating them into his Avodas Hashem. So let's talk about that a little bit more. Let's try to talk about it a little bit more of a Lemaisa way. Let's talk about professions. We discussed this a number of times, but this is really where it's so relevant. Which is a profession most appropriate for a conscientious Jew? So let's try to go by process of elimination. There are many professions that are clearly not suitable for a conscientious Jew because of the spiritual pitfalls that they present. Now you have to listen to this till the end, okay? But let's start going through the list. Let's start going through the list, okay? You're gonna be in business? That's not for a Jew, a conscientious Jew, because all the possible pitfalls of monetary matters and et cetera, integrity, et cetera, that makes business a dangerous area for the conscientious Jew. You're gonna be a doctor? A doctor, you know what kind of dangers there are there? First of all, the dangers of being a doctor is that a person grows insensitive to the suffering of the patients. That's one challenge for a doctor. Another challenge for a doctor is something Maharal talks about. A person becomes married to the natural process thinking. It's a natural cause and effect type of thinking. Person starts seeing everything as working within the box of nature. That's another very dangerous pitfall for a doctor. That's probably a profession best avoided by a conscientious Jew. Be a Rebbe? You know what kind of achrayus that is? You're going to be a Rebbe for cheder children? Take the achrayus of chinuch. You mess up a Jewish neshama, the stakes are very, very high. So I guess being a Rebbe, a cheder Rebbe, is also a job not for conscientious Jews. I don't know who, but if we go through the list, I can show you how every profession you can think of holds pitfalls for the conscientious Jew. So what's the answer? What's that?
Shepherd.
So the shepherd, also holds challenge. We know of the great seven shepherds, right? But what is the general attitude about shepherds in Chazal? Lowlifes, right? The fact that they are by themselves and not dealing with people turns them into coarse, self-centered people in a general way. And this actually brings out my point. It turns out, and in a general way, it's ad kedei kach that shepherds were considered from the least trustworthy people. We don't trust their testimony. By default, they're considered lowlifes. Oh, man, it's added up with the fact that the Shivaroim, right? Some of the greatest people in our history were shepherds. And this is exactly the point that I'm getting at. This is exactly the point that I'm getting at. The challenges of every profession, we have to translate them into the opportunities of every profession. In general, we have to translate the word challenge, nisayon, into opportunity. We've said this many times, we'll say it again, we'll probably say it a few more times, and we already know that I try not to be apologetic about repetition. Nisayon is from the word test, right? Challenge is from the word nace. Nace, not as in miracle right now, but as in a banner, right? A nace is a banner, a flag. What's the idea? The idea of a flag is something by which you hold up proudly, you show your identity proudly, whether it's a sports team, whether it's an army, whether it's a color war team, whatever it is. If you're waving a flag, what you're showing is, you're doing is you're showing, this is how I want you to identify me. This is how I affiliate myself. A nisayon, we view a challenge as like a curveball, something that a b'dieved, it got in the way, and I have to overcome it. But actually what a nisayon is Hashem coming and handing you the opportunity. This can be the banner that you will then proudly identify yourself by. The nisayonis are what make us. The nisayonis are what give us our character in Olam Haba. A person is facing a challenge and you think, oh, how am I going to deal with this challenge? But you also, the idea is Hashem is saying, I'm giving you the opportunity to come to Olam Haba as, well, you're going to identify yourself. I'm the one who, that's the banner you're going to be holding up. The nisayon that you were challenged with. I'm the one who made it through this. And therefore, let's come back to the different professions. You go into business, of course there are pitfalls. Olam Hazeh, what is one big potential pitfall? And therefore, the truth is you can also say that, Chazal did express it. Olam Hazeh is not a place for a conscientious Jew. Okay? Chazal kind of expressed that. Right? If you just plan to roll through life, Olam Hazeh is going to be a failure for you. And that's true for any field that the conscientious Jew is going to be in. If you're going to just, that the Jew is going to be in. If you're just going to roll, then you're going to get, whatever circumstance you are going to get yourself into trouble. Is wealth good for Ruchnius? Is poverty good for Ruchnius? Is health good for Ruchnius? Is illness good for Ruchnius? It's like the Messiah Sisharim said, all these things are nisyonis. They can either be pitfalls or they can be the means to your success. Or they can be the banners that you're going to be carrying to Olam Haba. I became great through wealth. I became great through poverty. I became great through health, etc. So, exactly. That's exactly the point. So now, we come back to our businessman and he's all worried about how can I go into business? What about all the different pitfalls of honesty, of the halachas of mamonis, of ribbis, etc., etc. We tell him exactly, this is now your claim to fame. You are meant, you know, Shamayim, the call to you is, you have to be the one to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim by showing that shining example of integrity, by showing that shining example of meticulousness and all the fine details of Hilchos Mamonis. Right? That's what the Messiah Yisharim says, that this is one of the greatest areas of Chassidus. He says, people can become pious in many areas. This is the real test. He says, you have people who can become pious in many areas, but here it's too hard when it comes to areas of money. And the person who does it there has really proven himself. So we turn it around and we say, of course there are pitfalls. Life is about pitfalls. Don't look for them, but you're going to have to make a living. And business might be your route. And therefore understand that the reason you're in business is to provide a shining example of that integrity, of I know a person who was trying to deal with the ins and outs of doing business with non-Jewish partners when it comes to the complications of running a business with the Shabbos angle of non-Jewish partners. So all too often, people just don't really think much of it, and whatever, it kind of runs how it does. And this person started really researching it, started seeing that it's mamish not pashut, and began consulting with Poskim. Then he went through the process. He actually identified one specific chashev rav who specializes in this area, and he got all involved with him. And he said, "One minute, this is such a complex area, and I'm learning so much, and this has so much bearing on my profession on a weekly basis. And there are tons of people out there who are in the dark. I have to bring this person to my kehillah to speak for everybody. Everybody should hear this." And he started making a whole ASIC out of it. That's an example of what we're talking about: spreading awareness, etc. And of course, we can now go back to all the different professions and all the different life circumstances and say, that's right. The challenges that they provide are exactly our means to greatness. And this was the story of Yaakov Avinu. This was the story of Yaakov Avinu. He did not have the luxury. Now, sometimes we often feel like, Hashem, this would be different in my life, and that would be different in my life, and that would be different in my life. I'd really be able to serve you optimally. But Hashem says, Shkoyach, but I don't need you to decide what to serve me. I want to order what I want from you, right? You come to a restaurant. Well, they say this story about the wife who sent her husband. She asked him to go pick up cauliflower, right, for this and this price. And he came back carrying three bags, bulging bags of beets. He said, "I was able to get this many beets for the same price. I figured it's a much better deal," right? So Hashem is saying, let me make the order. I have a very particular recipe that I want from you. Don't come and tell me, here, I'm telling you that I'd like you to put in potatoes, salt, X amount of eggs. And you come and tell me, but Hashem, that's going to be a very lousy luction kugel. I think we should put in instead the noodles and sugar instead of potatoes and salt. How can you get a good luction kugel with potatoes and salt?" And Hashem says, "I'm not asking you for a luction kugel. Don't offer me a luction kugel. I'm ordering a potato kugel." This is basically the idea. Hashem gives you the very particular life circumstances, which are a very specific recipe of what he wants from you. And the challenge is to be able to tackle them. And in Yaakov Avinu's case, it was first of all dealing with a man who doubled as a very what losing the word right now, but a very a conniving employer and a very challenging father-in-law. Each one on itself is enough to deal with. You have two in one. This is like a real clash of a package. And Yaakov the whole time with the ins and outs of dealing with this. And Yaakov makes such amazing statements at the end of the parasha where he says that you never absorbed the loss of one sheep over 20 years. Over 20 years. And I also know that when we would go to America for Pesach with the family, go to my parents' house, to my in-laws' house, whenever you come back, you open the suitcase, you're definitely going to find various household articles that originated from there. That's just the way it works. Yaakov comes after 20 years and says, "You're not going to find one item of your house among all my belongings." These are mind-boggling things. With all the story of the sticks, this is how Yaakov took that into a new path, right? We talk about drachim and avodas Hashem. Here was the derech of an innovative approach to Yiddishkeit, dealing with a very challenging employer. An innovative approach to Yiddishkeit, right? Going through the rigors of a very tough father-in-law, etc. And we take this and we apply this. Everybody has their own life circumstances. This is what we certainly apply it to family life. Family life. What we hear all the time is, and what we see all the time, experience all the time, is when you have, okay, everybody with their stage of life. But when you're talking to the mother who's at the stage of she has young kids in the house, she has kids who are having children and are very much leaning on her. She has parents who have needs, and she is just completely doesn't know what to do with herself. Right? Overrun, worn down, and the demands are non-ending, and the complaints are non-ending, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right? And if you're not yet at that stage, you still have whatever. If you're past that stage, there's plenty, right? There's plenty. So Rabbi Yerucham says something amazing, and this is really the point here. Rabbi Yerucham says as follows. I'm going to first say it in my own words. If each of us was to plan our path in Avodas Hashem, we would set ourselves up with plenty of time and space to really invest in davening and to be able to connect. As a man, I would set myself up with tons of space for real immersion in Torah learning, etc. We have beautiful spiritual visions. But then it seems to, but 1 minute, if you are meant to be, just say in my male terms, right? Making the efforts to be a good husband, a good father, and to make a parnasa, and to have a decent learning program with a little bit of efforts toward davening, et cetera. Each of these demand about 75% of the kairos. And you add it up, you easily come, you start adding a few more, you come to 500, 600% of the kairos. Right? Well, let's appreciate that this is exactly what Hashem is setting us up for. And again, as a husband, I realize full well that that probably pales in comparison with what my wife is carrying. So the idea is to understand that Hashem is saying, that's right. I know that if you were to set up your path of growth, you would set it up differently. But you don't really know exactly the recipe that's really going to bring you to your greatest place. And I'm adding in a whole bunch of ingredients toward what I want. Do you know how much patience you're supposed to insert into your spiritual program? And how would you set that up? If I want you to reach a certain level of patience, if I want you to reach a certain level of Noseba oil, etc. Do you know how to put all these things in? I'm going to tell you how I'm going to put it in. I'm going to put it in by putting all kinds of different people into your life who will push you toward that. So, but we take it a step further. And here's where Rabbi Yerucham says something that for me is so inspiring and so mechazen. He says like this. He says, we have a famous Mishnah that says, Hayom Katzar, V'Hamelacha Merubah, V'Poyalim Atzeilim, everybody's familiar with this mission. It says it's a mission in Pirkei Avos. The day is short. There's a lot of work to be done. And the boss, the Baal HaBayis, is pressuring. And that's obviously a mashal for Olam Hazeh. But Rabbi Yochum gives such a twist on it like this. He says, what do we mean by Baal HaBayis doichik? What does it mean that Baal HaBayis is pressuring? He says, Hashem says to us, I want to get you to the highest place you can get. I want you to end up with as much Olam Haba as you can get. And therefore, Hashem says, you don't know quite how much you're capable of. And therefore, if you were to set up your own path, you would give yourself the space you need and you'd be on a comfortable path of moving forward, of progress. I trust you. You would set up a path of progress, but you would go at a pace that you consider reasonable. But I'm going to be showering it on you, I'm going to be piling it on. And you're going to feel like it's just too much to keep up with. But this is my way of ensuring that you really are getting this chusim wholesale at a much higher and faster rate. And you might feel like, yeah, but I'm dropping half the balls. I'm breaking things all over the place. At the end of the day, you're huff and puff to keep up with the very rapid pace that I'm piling it on and that I'm throwing them at you is actually bringing you to a much greater and higher place. So this is the Balabai's doichet. Hashem is showering us with opportunity. And it's to opportunity that we just can't keep up with. And we feel like we're dropping things all over the place. But this is Hashem's way of moving us ahead much faster and to a much higher place than we would naturally get to by trying to set it up ourselves.
Sometimes it can just feel like you're failing all the time. If you just, you said the wrong thing to this one and you lost your temper, and like it's just you're too overwhelmed all the time. You could just beat yourself up, and I don't think you end up in a higher place. You just feel bad and worse.
That's
And
right. And that's why I hope you came here today, because what we're trying to do is turn that around a bit, meaning as follows. Let's address what you said. Basically, what you're asking is, what do we gain by that all that rigor if at the end of the day all it causes is many failures, and then I'm just beating myself up because of all the things that I didn't manage to respond to right, etc. So the truth is, yeah, what we're trying to do is a person can definitely just roll through life, whatever the case is, failing. But, and here are the few buts that we're really trying to lay down now. So first of all, once you have the consciousness that this rigor is the goal, this rigor is the precise recipe that Hashem set up for me. And yes, I have to be keeping track of the various areas in life and knowing what I want to get out of them, knowing how my interactions with the people around me is about polishing my midos, knowing that, as we've been saying before, the nisyonos are opportunities. That's really, instead of going into the particulars and the details, that mindset that the nisyonos are opportunities, and to be viewing it that way, to be taking stock every so often, where can I be realizing those opportunities? Then realize that if you're on that track, don't be discouraged by the failures, because Hashem set it up such, he's basically telling you, if you're on that track, you're going to have failures. It's true. Except when you're trying to juggle five balls and you can only hold two at the same time, and you're not a very good juggler, you juggle like I do, then yes, you're dropping them every so often. But don't let that get you down. Realize that the path itself is a path of success. It's a path of harvesting very great things. When you are living on a path of supporting a family, raising a family, being involved with a family, you're busy giving and giving and giving, and yes, you will also be failing. You'll also be failing. Put those failures into perspective. See them against the bigger picture. Don't let them get you down. And yes, regroup, apply yourself again, but do it with the understanding that all of this is Hashem's way of piling it on at a rate that's really getting you to a higher place. It's true. What we're saying now is, don't beat yourself up. Keep yourself in check. Keep on top of what's going on. Don't let yourself just sail along. But realize that I am in a path. This is the path of Yaakov Avinu. I am on that path of greatness. I'm a path on a path of taking the ingredients that Hashem gives me and working with them. And that's my way of getting myself to the highest place possible. Obviously, we can get into many, many, many details, but this covers so many aspects of our lives. We can talk about this in the realm of working for Parnassah. We can talk about this in the realm of family. We can talk about this in the realm of all the different challenges that we face in life. So we might say that that is the aspect of Yaakov Avinu. It's blazing a trail of growth by following the life that Hashem is dictating for him, and moving ahead with that with a sense of mission rather than just feeling like I'm being tossed in all directions and blown about by the wind. Okay, now let's see if we can come back and address some of the questions that were raised. The first question that was raised, and you can remind me if there were more, I'll try to touch on them briefly now, was about naming. How did the Avos go about naming their children? So it's very interesting. The bottom line answer seems to be that they were really guided by a divine sense, meaning as follows. It's very interesting. Today, it's accepted in Klal Yisrael to name after ancestors. Now, where does that come from? Because if you look back to biblical times, if you look back to the times of Tanakh, it didn't work that way. They were naming on the basis of the significance of the child, of his birth, of the circumstances surrounding it. So the Medrash Max tells us where in history that changed. It's very interesting. changed in the time of the Tanoim, the period surrounding the Churban, meaning it's not a recent thing. It was a very distinct change in the trend. Everybody can probably, if you're a little bit familiar with the Tanaim, we know about Rav Gamliel, Rav Shimon Gamliel, Gamliel, Rav Shimon, Rav Shimon Gamliel. You already see there the trend began of naming like your ancestors. The Medrash names two reasons for it. The Medrash names two reasons for it. First of all, it says we lost Ruach HaKodesh, which means that the ability to name carries a lot of significance, and the ability to really give the child the name that's right for him actually requires a certain sense of Ruach HaKodesh. And the Medrash says that Ruach HaKodesh waned, and therefore we rode on previous names. That's number one. And number two, the second point that the Medrash says is that in the travails of the Galus, it's a means of preserving names. It's a means of preserving memories. And those are the two reasons why the trend in the time of the Tanaim shifted to giving names for ancestors, giving names for people in the family.
What happened to the people in Haran that he going down to the that he was?
I'm sorry. Let me see if we can. I'm still trying to keep track of the various questions that came up, but that's a good question. Let's see if we can get to it. So, but what we see from this medrash is that the trend of naming, the concept was to name a child with something identifying the significance of that child, but it was actually guided by Ruach HaKodesh. Okay. The other questions that came up, and I'm keeping track of this also, I'm not sure in which order, but the question of the trickery. Why did Yaakov Avinu get the brachas through trickery? So that's a tough question to answer. Let's answer it in two steps. The first step is that he was operating at the command of a Nevi'ah. Of a Nevi'ah, of his mother. She commanded him to do it. We see that he himself, actually in the pasuk, expressed his discomfort with it, but she insisted that he do it, and she was coming from the nevuah that she received from Shem Ve'eva. So then there's a very interesting question of how come she never conveyed that nevuah to Yitzchak? And even more than that, or to put the question together, why did she choose this route? It's a very strange route to choose, rather than come and say, Yitzchak, I got a nevuah. This is how it's meant to be. So there's a lot to be said about that. I'll just give you one take that Rav Hirsch says. Rav Hirsch says something amazing. He says, Esav did an amazing job really confusing reality for Yitzchak, right? He was apparently had the charisma and the polish to real and the food, that's right, to really paint it such that he was the pious, conscientious, energetic, right, son. Now, there are other takes on this. There are other takes according to which Yitzchak was not as innocent as we might have thought, but here, even assuming he wasn't innocent, Esav was good at he was good at what he did. And Rivka understood that Yitzchak has such an ingrained impression and opinion of Esav. If he's simply told, yeah, but it has to be the other way, it wouldn't be b'chol nafshei. It wouldn't be b'chol libo. Right? He would do it because, okay, he was told to do it, but it would go against his grain.
Worse. Thank you.
So what Rav Hirsch says is, what she came and did was, she showed him reality, threw it in his face. Look how easy it is. This was basically what she did with that whole trick. She came and showed him, look how easy it is to see something clearly, and the opposite is true. That was, Rav Hirsch says, what she was bringing out. And that's why it says, because he got it. It hit him like a ton of bricks. She basically came and said, it wasn't she was tricking him. She was bringing home exactly that point. I wouldn't be able to convince you that Esav is really Yaakov and Yaakov is really Esav. But look, now you actually, Yaakov, did a couple of tweaks and you were sure he was Esav. So Rav Hirsch says, this hit him like a ton of bricks, and that's why it says, Vayechar Yitzchok Charod Gdol Ad Me'od. He trembled because he said, if I could so easily be misled, who knows where else? What else was pulled over me? Sayin Pepe means that Yitzchak Esav had that talent. Okay, there's one. Well, you know what? Let's see if we can get back to that. But 1 minute, there were other questions that were brought up. A whole bunch of questions were brought up at the beginning, and I'm trying to. What's that? Where does the food come? Okay. This is also a chashuva point. Let's appreciate the role that food really plays in avodas Hashem. The role that a good taste really plays in avodas Hashem. The Ramban says this point in short. It's elaborated more in other places. Avigdor Miller talked about it. If something has a good taste, or if something has a material appeal, a physical appeal, it's meant to be a stepping stone toward nobler things. Meaning there's two approaches you could take. You could take the approach toward nobler things. Meaning you could take the approach of it's simply meant to be overcome. That's the whole purpose. It's meant to be overcome. But if we'll just talk in broad terms, the way we always talk about it, is that the good taste of food is actually meant to be a means of connecting to Hashem and experiencing His kindliness. The Ramban tells us, and this is something that we see often in the Nevi'im, that they would use good food in order to move themselves into, they would actually focus on the good taste. They could have been pious and just swallow it down without tasting it. But just as we know that for Nevuah, a person has to be in a certain state of mind. So they would use music to shift them into that state of mind. They could also use food to get them into that state of mind. We generally think as music as something more noble than food. It's not necessarily so. Music appeals more to the emotions and food appeals more to the goof, but it really depends at the end of the day how you're using each one. And in Nach, there was a lot of use of food toward connecting with what it was they wanted to connect with. If we'll say it in our terms, I guess it's more relevant to me as a husband, unless you have a husband who's in the kitchen. You can use food as a means of appreciating your wife. Enjoy the food and appreciate, use the different things that your spouse does to make life more pleasant. Instead of being a tzaddik and not enjoying the pleasantness, focus on the pleasantness and use it as a way of appreciating and connecting. And this is how Yitzchak Avinu operated also. He enhanced his love for his son by making a point of enjoying the things that his son provided for him. And this, the Ramban says, was what he told Esav right before he gave him the brachas. Bring me a meal. Why did he tell him, bring me one? He's planning ahead. He wants to give him these brachas. Not like it was necessarily be on the spot, right? So why can't he plan to spend the day, you know, go to the mikveh and say Tehillim, etc., be in the highest state possible? The Ramban says he wanted to connect to Esav by means of the food that Esav would provide to him, and likshor nafshoy benafshoy, to connect his nefesh to his nefesh. They put a lot of thought into the material experiences, into the physical experiences they were having, to bring themselves to higher places. This was also how the love between a husband and wife was built. They didn't just take the natural feelings, the way it works in the world at large, is that you take the natural feelings, you don't invest any work into it. As soon as the natural feelings run out, because that's the way physical pleasures work, then you drop it like hot potatoes, move on to the next stage. That's what Victor Miller said, excuse me. But this is what he says. So what's the best way to end the romance? Marriage. So the idea being that if you're not going to take the natural feelings and then invest in them, conscientious effort to get them to the right place, Hashem wants me to connect with this person. Let me take the natural feelings and use them as a medium, not to ride on them that begins and ends with that, but use it as a medium to then build something deeper and deeper and deeper, which turns into real love, not just superficial love. That's actually the result of a lot of effort, appreciation, and focus. This is what the others did with food as well. That is the broad answer of where food came into the relationship between Yitzchak and Esav. What was the last question you asked? But Rabbi said the rest of this is not on the test, so Okay.
What happened to all the people that are living in Haran? They never talk about it. They never
Yeah.
say anything.
Oh,
They
that we what happened?
what happened to them? They didn't.
What happened to all the people that Yaakov, that
Yeah.
Avraham was Makarov? We touched on that briefly the other week. And basically the answer is that that's right. They lasted for a generation or two, but they petered out. That was why they were very good. But they didn't manage to convey it properly to their children or to their grandchildren. And that's exactly why Avraham Avinu so badly wanted his own seed. It was because he saw that with all these people, it'll last for a generation, two generations. But if I really want it to be perpetuated, I need my own seed. More to be said about that, but we'll stop here for now. Continue.